Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Tuesday the 16th of April, the sun is set to shine and this is Game On as the search for the men's Ireland manager looks set to rumble on. Tony O'Donoghue sits down with Sean O'Shea and it's Champions League Tuesday. Didi Haman and Mark Langdon preview the quarterfinal second leg games for us.
Some big news in the world of boxing. Katie Taylor is going to fight Amanda Serrano once again, this time in Texas. Kevin Byrne has the latest. Plus, we're going to speak to Paul Townend on his grand national success. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552. We're on X at GameOn2FM. Or you can WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome along.
It's a quiet Tuesday, Marie, isn't it?
There's a lot happening today, from the Champions League to Katie Taylor. Good bit of excitement for people who like the big mainstream sports.
Oh, it is, but that's, I suppose Katie Taylor's news came a bit earlier. Champions League games are still to look forward to, but there's no Jolly Barrett news today. Or...
Well, yesterday was spectacular now, to be fair.
Yeah.
And the timing of it was great, and the anticipation, and people weren't really sure.
I know, yeah, it's such a big name as well, and just have news like that every day, Marie, to be.
Wouldn't we just love
just
that?
Be a better show, wouldn't it?
Anyway, I did want to talk to you about something since we don't
What did I usually? I've done something wrong when you want to talk to me about something.
But I wanted to get your take on the Chelsea penalty last night and the shenanigans that went on around it. So there was three or four probably wanted to take the penalty. They were fighting about it, trying to hang on to the ball. It just looked like they were children.
I kind of didn't want to say that because it's half insulting to children. But yes, that is, it looked very unprofessional, very unorganised for a professional outfit. And you would imagine there would be, should be, someone in charge. I mean, what's the point in having a captain? Why do they appoint captains on teams? Just to go out and win the toss? Or not even win the toss, just to stand there for the toss and see what happens. Like, why didn't the captain just stand in and make a decision?
Dele Alli was on afterwards on the telly and he made a really good point that when the pressure's on, you don't see them fighting over the ball, but when they're 3 or 4 nil up, they all want to take the penalty.
Yeah, sure, that's typical, isn't it?
Well, Didi Haman joins us now. Didi, how are you?
Hello.
How
good
are
evening.
You? Can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Oh, great. We were just chatting about the Chelsea penalty drama last night and Ruby was wondering, should the captain not just get in there and say, you're not taking it or you're taking it? What should happen in that scenario?
Well, I think you've got a penalty taker and regardless of the scoreline, I think whoever is put up by the manager before the game should take it. I think it was Cole Palmer. And even though he scored 3 goals, or even more so, you know, if the manager thinks before the game he's a man to take a penalty, then he should take it.
He did say, Pochettino, afterwards that Cole Palmer is the penalty taker and he should have taken it and from now on that he'll be taking it. But I think the damage has been done because even though they were really impressive and Cole Palmer had that brilliant game, the big talk afterwards, the main talk afterwards, Mark Langdon, is about this penalty and the behaviour of the players.
Crazy, isn't it, for Chelsea? You know, even when they have their best night of the season, people still want to talk about sort of outside influences. It's not even the first time this season there's been a disagreement over who takes the Chelsea penalties. Cole Palmer, I think it was Raheem Sterling earlier on in the season. So either they've not set it out properly before the game, it's not on the board or whatever, or the players have taken it upon themselves to sort of manage the situation during the game, which is, as Didi says, you know, completely wrong. Does show a lack of leadership, I think, at Chelsea, and it's been a problem for them on the pitch this season. They are, you mentioned it right at the top, that, you know, it was a sort of the act of a child, and they are a very young team. It was completely amateurish and unprofessional, and taken the gloss off of, you know, what was that their best sort of a most complete performance of the season. It can't happen again. It surely won't happen again either. But I think that Nicholas Jackson's behaved very strangely throughout the season, actually. He got himself involved in a number of situations that have had nothing to do with him. And yeah, hopefully, you know, from his point of view and Chelsea's point of view, they kind of learn from it and are able to move forward. But I think it does go to show some of the things that Pochettino's trying to deal with in that dressing room.
Well, Chelsea players have the next couple of nights off, but a lot of players don't. And Didi, you're obviously in Dublin because it is Champions League night. Are you looking forward to it?
I certainly do. Knockout stages in the Champions League, always big nights. Eight fantastic teams left. Obviously, PSG with a lot of work to do, away to Barcelona and Dortmund. Nobody gave them a chance. They went in the toughest group with AC Milan, Newcastle and PSG. Got to the last eight and they've got a brilliant opportunity to go to the semi-final.
They were a bit off it in the first half against Atletico Madrid the last night. Back in Dortmund, the yellow wall. Are you favouring them?
I'm not sure. Atletico is always a tough nut to crack, but as you say, they've got 80,000 behind them. They're only a goal behind. Got outplayed in the first half, but they pulled it back, and in the end, they hit the crossbar in the last minute. They could have got out with a draw. Do I favour them? I think they've got a very good chance, but I'd probably still say that their favourites are Atletico, because they need to score at least one, probably two goals. And we know how they play. They probably waste time from the first minute onwards. That's what they do. That's what they probably do best than anybody else. They, in terms of game management, I think they're as good as anyone, Atletico Madrid. And they've also got weapons going forward. So, yeah, it'll be tough for Dortmund, but at least they are still in it.
Mark, Atletico's form on the road this year has been somewhat suspect. Would you be worried about that for them?
I would be, yeah. And you only have to go back to the last round of the Champions League to see the difference between Atletico at home and away. I thought they were awful away to Inter. Could have had the tie sort of gone away from them. And they were able to play much better at home with that big crowd behind them. Sort of more positive. I think it suits them when they are not as negative as what they're probably going to be this evening, because they just get into that defensive mindset and you just invite pressure. And actually, as Didi was saying, you know, you've got players of the quality of Griezmann and Morata that can hurt opponents, but they don't seem to have any interest in trying to give them the freedom and kind of the opportunity to shine. I think that probably if you look at it just from a purely odds point of view, Atletico are going to be the favourites to qualify, but wouldn't surprise me at all if Dortmund managed to overturn the deficit at home. They're inconsistent side, Dortmund, but if you catch them on a kind of a good night, like when they played at Munich a couple of weeks ago and won that game convincingly, that they can still hurt opponents. So wouldn't be surprised at all, actually, if this one went beyond 90 minutes and we maybe had extra time and even penalties.
Didi, what about PSG and Barcelona? Again, a finely poised one. How important is it going to be for Kylian Mbappe to show some consistency and put in a performance tonight?
Yeah, well, I don't think PSG is worried about consistency. It's all about tonight's game, because they're 10 points ahead in the league. But obviously, this is the title they want to win, and Mbappe's form is a bit of a worry. He's been pretty quiet, or very quiet, in the first leg. Then again, they've got other players. Bacaula came on, did really well. Dembele. We might see Gonzalo Ramos tonight. The biggest worry, I thought they've really got a chance this year, because Mbappe probably goes in the summer. It's probably the best chance. I wouldn't say the last chance, but probably the best chance for the next 5 or 6 years. The big worry for me is Donnarumma. He's been a brilliant goalkeeper, won the Euros in England not long ago. I don't know what happened to him, but he's just an accident waiting to happen. He's been at fault for so many goals this season. Didn't do well at all in the first leg. And if you haven't got a good goalkeeper or an outstanding goalkeeper, it's almost impossible to win big titles. And at the moment, he's not.
Mark, when you look at PSG, the last couple of times they've gone out of the Champions League, they've kind of gone out sort of half-bad-tempered. They're fairly liable for red cards and yellow cards when they start losing games like this.
They are capable of losing the plot, losing their heads. It's sort of in their DNA over the last decade, really, that they kind of go out disgracefully when they do exit the Champions League, and they've found so many different ways to go out of the competition. I don't think this tie's over, despite the fact that they're 3-2 behind. There was a spell in the second half when I thought they were all over Barcelona and looked like they were going to kind of extend their lead and go 3-1 up, and then Pedri came on, brilliant ball, Rafinha equalised, and then they conceded from a set piece. I think the fact that Hakimi is back from suspension is a big, big positive for Paris, because Marquinhos played right back in the first half of that game in the first leg, and I don't think he's ever played right back before, and it showed. He was all at sea, and Barcelona definitely targeted him. And Mbappe, as far as he's concerned, he's a brilliant player. You know, you could say he's the best player in the world when he kind of is having a going day. When he's not, he can be selfish and he can be lazy. And Paris Saint-Germain need the kind of the best of Mbappe to turn up if they're to overturn this deficit. But he's capable and they're capable. I think this will be a brilliant game. Can only see goals, and still don't think it's over, even though they're 3-2 behind.
So the Barcelona-PSG game is on RTE2 television and the RTE player at 7.45 this evening. Didi, I know we have to let you go, but just before you do, just your thoughts on Liverpool, where they're at after their last two disappointing results, and do you think the wheels have come off?
Well, it looks that way. It certainly hasn't made it easier. Everybody was saying, or people were saying, oh, they can concentrate on the league now after losing 3-0 at home to Atalanta. Now you get beat by Palace at home. I think they've got to feel their strongest team. I don't think it's over. Going to Atalanta, 3 goals in 90 minutes should be possible for the Liverpool team. The worry is obviously the form. But then again, if you look at the games, or especially the game on Sunday, there's so many chances. They just have to find somebody who puts him away in Nunes. You know, I think he's got everything a top-class player needs. But if he don't score goals as a centre-forward, missing easy chances as easy as he does miss them, then you've got to say, is he a player who can succeed at Liverpool? At the moment, I'd probably say no. And in the league, they've got 3 away games now. They still got to go to Villa. I think they go to West Ham, go to Fulham on the weekend. And City is just it's just a well-oiled machine. So I think in the league, I think it'll be very, very tough to come back. I probably think the better chance is now on Thursday to really have a go. If you score an early goal, I think anything's possible. And we all know where the final is. So hopefully we see them in a few weeks in Dublin.
Definitely. Didi, thank you so much. Enjoy the game. We'll all be tuning in when we get home this evening. Appreciate you taking the time. Mark, give us your take. Have the wheels come off Liverpool, or is it just a little blip?
I think it's a little blip. You know, I sort of agree that they were punching above their weight at certain parts of this season. But on another day, Crystal Palace are beaten quite convincingly in that second half. There were enough chances. I'd be more worried about the Atalanta performance, because defensively, I thought Liverpool were all over the place, really, in that game. And despite creating some chances, it looked like Atalanta were going to score every time they went forward. And that's a problem, I think, with the whole collective. I don't think that's all down just to the defenders. You know, when you kind of concede that amount of goals and those opportunities that they did, Klopp will always talk about the collective. You know, are they pressing correct from the front? The midfield was too open, and then that puts pressure on the defence. But I'd prefer to look at the bigger picture and say that I still think Liverpool have got the maximum out of their team so far this season. And if they fall short, say, in the Premier League by a couple of points, I don't think that that should be seen as, you know, a disaster or a crisis or anything like that. I think, you know, if you fall short to Manchester City, it's just one of those things. The disappointment will be that they've come so far, and yeah, it was looking like at one stage the quadruple and stuff like that. And I think that was always very, very ambitious, and the wheels have come off slightly, but I prefer to look at the bigger picture, and I still think over the course of the season, they're having a good season. Same with Arsenal. You know, Arsenal could go out tomorrow of the Champions League. They might not win the Premier League, and that will be seen as them choking and bottling it. I disagree. I just think that there's a limit to what Arsenal and sort of Liverpool are capable of doing, and it's not quite at the standard that Manchester City are probably going to reach.
Mark, I was in Anfield last Thursday night, and what surprised me most was how Atalanta was so much more physical than Liverpool. Liverpool fell off every ball. Atalanta looked the bigger, older, stronger team. But then,
I think there might be a case of some of the players are running on empty, and there'll be some fans that kind of, you know, scream at footballers and think they should never get tired because of the money they get paid. But you know, I don't think how, you know, you can get paid millions of pounds. It doesn't stop you actually being tired. And at that level, you only have to be a couple of percent off it, and it shows. And I think there are some players that are just coming back from injury that haven't quite picked up that pace yet. And even on Sunday, you saw that Trent Alexander-Arnold misplacing passes, Jota not as ice cold as what he usually is in front of goal. And so, yeah, it's one thing these players being fit enough to play, but whether they're actually at full fitness from, you know, that physicality point of view and just the rhythm, probably not. And as I just said, you only have to be off it a couple of percent at the top level, and it's too much. So I think it's a combination of all of these little things just coming together to go against Liverpool at the moment.
Moving further afield, and it was happening for a long time, but Leverkusen, Mark, what a story that is.
Yeah, absolutely, Ruby. First Bundesliga title under Xabi Alonso. They've absolutely, you know, thrashed Bayern Munich. It looked like Munich were kind of invincible, really, and would just, I don't know, dominate the Bundesliga for another decade, but deservedly falling short this season against the Leverkusen team that's brilliantly coached by Alonso. I think we've spoken many times on this Tuesday slot about the job that he's done. You know, there was a spell in the middle of the campaign when it looked like maybe they would get reeled in because they kept scoring last minute winners, and you wondered how sustainable that would be. Since then, they've actually gone on. They thrashed Bayern at home, and I think that was the game, really. That was the real turning point that gave them the belief that, yes, they are going to go on and complete the job. They've got some wonderful players. Florian Wirtzen sort of plays an attacking midfielder, I think, is somebody that will go on and play, you know, for one of Europe's elite clubs. Boniface up front has been injured for the second half of the season. He's come back, started scoring goals again. Another one that, you know, he'll leave Leverkusen, you would have thought, at some stage. But a nice story because, you know, they were mercifully sort of taunted for being this team that couldn't win trophies, and, you know, that the nickname Neverkusen sort of thrown at them. And now this season, they've won the Bundesliga. They've got a second division team in the German Cup final. They're favourites to win the Europa League after that 2-0 victory against West Ham. So they could end up with a treble this season, and they still haven't lost a game all season long. So the chance to go invincible with it as well. And, you know, if you thought Alonso's reputation was high sort of when he was being linked with the Liverpool job, imagine what it'll be like in the summer if he pulls that one off. So, you know, whenever he leaves, Alonso, I still think it'll be Real Madrid that he eventually goes to, but he's going to have his the pick of the clubs. He's done a brilliant job.
Yeah, I don't know if Liverpool will be able to afford him when that time comes. He'll be... He'll be one of those ones that'll be just out of reach, I'd imagine. Just while we're on German football, any sympathy for Harry Kane, who left Spurs to go to Bayern Munich in search of trophies, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen for him?
I've got a certain amount of sympathy because he, on an individual level, has had a fine season, scored a lot of goals, created goals. You know, he couldn't have done any more, I don't think. The team has fallen apart. Thomas Tuchel's leaving at the end of the season. And you say it's unlikely to end in a trophy, but they are still in the Champions League, got that 2-2 draw against Arsenal in the first leg. So maybe, I mean, they've got a lot of work to do.
It's not the Arsenal game.
Then,
I worry about it. It's what comes after the Arsenal game.
Yeah, Real Madrid or Man City, you would think would beat them. But it's not all over from that point of view. That would be where the sympathy sort of lies. But there will be people say that, you know, this is Harry Kane's sort of career so far. He's been able to shine as an individual, but the team collective hasn't been enough to go on and win trophies. And at some stage, you wonder if he's got anything to do with that. I would lean towards it's just one of those things. And like, if he stays at Bayern for another couple of years, I think they will get one of those Bundesligas eventually.
Mark, we're going to switch to Irish football for just a few minutes. I'm sure you're well aware about the latest with what's been happening on the manager front. So we know that there's now confusion about when we're going to hear who the next Republic of Ireland manager will be. We thought it would be early April, but it seems like that's not going to be the case, and we're just not sure. So there's speculation earlier this morning that Chris Hughton is going to get the job. He emerged as now the favourite. We're not sure, though. One man who's also in the mix is John O'Shea. He took interim charge for those two games against Belgium and Switzerland. Well, he was back in the Aviva today, John O'Shea, in his role as the ambassador for the UEFA Europa League final, which takes place on May 22nd. And he was chatting to Tony O'Donoghue initially about how he reflects on that doubleheader a few weeks back.
We were fortunate, obviously, in Manchester. We were playing in the different UEFA competition, the Champions League one. So, no, I never got to get to grips with it. But it's proven to be an exciting competition this year. And you see the standard and the quality of the teams left in it as well. So, hopefully, I've no doubt there'll be two quality teams preparing for the final in Dublin very soon.
Now, Liverpool are facing an uphill task, we have to admit that. Liverpool fans will be, I suppose, amused to have me asking you, a Man United legend, about their chances. But at 3-0 down, do they have a chance?
I think they do, because their recent history would tell you that they do. And as well, I was actually at the game itself. They did create plenty of chances. On another night, they definitely would have got a couple of goals. But the problem they probably have is at Atalanta, that look like they can score too at will, and they're a talented outfit. It was just an interesting game to watch in terms of how Atalanta went about the kind of their aggressive tactics against Liverpool, and they were able to catch them out.
Liverpool dropping points against Man United though, and then Crystal Palace. Is that them out of the Premier League title, do you think?
Look, it's gave Man City a massive advantage, hasn't it? And obviously Arsenal then as well, dropping a few points too. It was a big weekend for Man City.
Now, the final is in Dublin. I'm sure you'll be around for that as well, will you?
Yeah, there's every chance I will be, yeah. There's every chance, yeah. I'm hoping to get over for the final, yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask you about the Irish manager's job. You were expecting that, I know, but you had your two games in charge. When you reflect on them, what do you think?
Look, Tony, it was an amazing honour to manage our country, and one that I was obviously always preparing for in terms of when you get involved in coaching and being involved with the 21s and then with the seniors. So it just gave me a taste for more, really.
At the end of it, you said you made no secret of your desire that you would want to manage your country. Are you ready to take that up now, considering there's no manager as yet named?
Yeah, well, look, as you said, there's no manager yet named, and it's always the case for me that it will always be an honour to be involved with the Irish setup, and if I am to be the manager, brilliant. But that's all the news we have on it, if you know what I mean. I've no update on anything, and as I said, that'll be the case. If and when I do, I'd love to tell you.
Jonathan Hill, who was announced yesterday, is leaving his post. Has anyone contacted you since you were the manager for those games against Belgium and Switzerland?
Yeah, look, I've been in touch with Mark Canham, obviously, just obviously talking about the two games itself. And obviously he's just been updating me as best he can on what's happening going forward. And ultimately there was no proper update, if you know what I mean. They're obviously trying to progress things as quick as they can.
There's two games coming up. We've got Portugal away, and we've got Hungary back here at the Aviva Stadium. Would you take on the interim role again?
Look, let's wait and see. It'd be one of them, Tony. I think for me, the experience I've gained now from the last two games has just given me an appetite and a knowledge to know that, look, I can and will be a manager going forward, and whatever happens then happens.
What surprised you most about being in the job?
Not that I won't say nothing surprised me, but it's just the fact of when you're working with staff beforehand, and now ultimately picking the starting 11, you take advice from your staff, but ultimately the tough decisions that you have to make on an 11 is down to you, and that's ultimately that's what it was. The starting 11 was down to me, and the way it was, because it was two friendlies, I didn't even have to cut numbers for the substitutes even, so sometimes that can be a challenge as well. But it was one I was more than capable of, and one I really enjoyed.
Would you think then managers have to be decisive? Would you say to the FAI that I won't be the interim, that I want to be the main man now? There is no one else, and you've had a lot of support from the Irish public.
Yeah, look, as I said, Tony, I'd love it to be the case, and if and when, I would be ready to take on that challenge.
Now, look at the other games left in this Europa League. We've got games at a knife edge, you might say, because Roma and AC Milan, the Italian one, there's only a goal in that one.
Yeah, as I mentioned, the quality of the teams. If it was to be Roma or AC Milan in the final in Dublin, that itself would attract a huge attendance as well. And you're not to mention the historical teams, Marseille, Benfica, obviously Liverpool, Atalanta. Incredible opposition, and hopefully an amazing final leads the way to Dublin.
Well, listen, we look forward to the final. Have you a hotel booked?
No, I'm only down the road in Waterford, Tony. It's not too far. I'll be able to travel up.
Listen, best of luck to you and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
John O'Shea there speaking to Tony O'Donoghue. Mark Langdon from the Racing Post is with us on the line as well. Mark, are we any clearer on anything after that, do you think?
Well, I mean, John O'Shea, he clearly wants the job there, doesn't he? I mean, he's kind of, you can't go all in, and you know that would be sort of not the right sort of political move, I think, from John O'Shea. But he's put his name in the hat as much as he can do. I think it's pretty unfair what's going on and the way that it's dragging on, and you know whoever then does come into the job, you know, potentially thinks, well, I wasn't first choice, was I even second choice or third choice or whatever. So I think it's time really for the FAI to act decisively and get the person that they want in, because this can't be good for anybody in the process. But ultimately, if the new manager comes in and is successful, nobody will care how long it took, and we, you know, the kind of you'll soon forget this part of it. But I don't think it's been an amazing process, given that you know it's dragged on. So many names have been chucked into the hat, and now if you're deciding between John O'Shea and Chris Hughton, potentially. I mean, they're two very different sort of guys that are in different stages of their career. And it does make you wonder if kind of anybody knows exactly what it is they do want in the next manager, which should have been sort of decided, I think, a long time ago.
I don't know, but it's starting to look like me that the only one that wants it is John O'Shea. So do you end up giving it to someone because you're giving them enough of money, or do you give it to somebody that actually wants the job? I can't understand why you just haven't giving it to the man to consider it an honour compared to, because they can't find anybody else. I mean, how long are we talking about it now? Early April, they said. We're now in the middle of April. They don't have anyone. That's what looks obvious to me. Mark?
Well, I mean, I think you get the best person you can get, but I do agree that you don't want some kind of mercenary in there, and somebody that is only doing it for the money. And you know, if that was to be kind of, you know, I know sort of, you know, there's been a few foreign names that have been mentioned. You think back to, I know, someone like Trapattoni or whatever. I don't think you need it needs to be somebody that wants the job. I agree with that, but they've also got to be able to do it. I mean, this is, you know, a pretty big job for somebody. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, so I don't think it can only go to somebody that wants it. I think they've got to be able to do it, and you know, either, whether that's a vision that they sold to the FAI or a CV that is kind of, you know, makes them worthy. So O'Shea hasn't got the managerial career, but if he can plot out you know, a process and how he wants the team to play and how he's going to do it and how he's going to work with the under-21s or, you know, whatever that process is, then that's fine. But I don't think you can just give the job to somebody because they want it and because they seem like they're a sort of good, fun person and would kind of want the job. I think it needs to be more than that. I mean, we are talking about, you know, a pretty prestigious role that's required and has had some big names in the past. So I think it needs to be a balance between not just being silly about just giving it to somebody for the money, but offering enough money that you kind of get the right person that fancies it as well.
Yeah, it makes sense. Just hopefully somebody gets it at some stage, because it's a saga and I feel like we're just repeating ourselves over and over again. Early April's passed. We're mid-April now, so maybe by the end of April or sometime in the very near future.
Mark, April 2025, maybe.
Mark, as always, thank you for all of that. We're going to take a really quick break. Stay with us. We're going to be talking about Katie Taylor's big Texas showdown. Plus, we have Paul Townend standing by as well to talk about his Grand National success.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We're going to turn our attention to boxing now. News broke a little bit earlier that Katie Taylor will face Amanda Serrano for a second time on the undercard of Mike Tyson and Jake Paul on the 20th of July in Texas. To talk us through the specifics, I'm delighted to say that Kevin Byrne from The Sun joins us now. Kevin, first of all, what is your thoughts in general about this whole setup, the fact that Katie will be on the undercard of an exhibition fight, albeit a very big fight?
First of all, Marie, and how's it going, Marie and Ruby? First of all, I'm pretty pleased that the fight is going to take place. It did seem as if it's a much demanded rematch. I think boxing fans want to see it. The first fight was so good, a fight of the year. that it was looking like it wasn't going to happen. Serrano's name has been mentioned in conjunction with Taylor's for a while, but, you know, the fight has fallen through a lot, and I thought it was going to be difficult to make, so I'm glad it's made. I know a lot of people are animated about the fact that it is taking place as like a co-headline or a co-feature, or effectively on the undercard, to a bit of a freak fight, a circus fight, as has been called by Katie Taylor's promoter, Eddie Hearn himself. Mike Tyson's got to be nearly 50, he's going to be 58 years old when he gets in the ring against Jake Paul in Texas.
That's old.
It's an exhibition fight or whatever. It's a fight I don't think... I think it's simultaneously a fight nobody wants to see, but it's probably going to be the most watched bout of the year. It's circus stuff. I don't think the genuine boxing fans are really energised by it, but that's not to say people aren't event junkies, and I think people are going to watch this around the world. The fact that it's on Netflix, it's readily available. I don't think there's going to be an extra fee, so if you subscribe to Netflix, you'll get this fight. I think it's going to be I think it's going to be a big success of a show, and there's nothing people can do about that.
I love the way they paint that one. Once you're a subscriber to Netflix, it's free, but you have to subscribe to networks. A bit like said, it's free if it's on Sky, as long as you have a subscription, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a good play on it, but go on, sorry.
There's no additional box office charge, which Katie Taylor's TV network, subscription network, DAZN, have started doing. They said if you subscribe to our package, you won't have to pay additional pay-per-views, but then they reneged on that, and lots of them do, so, yeah.
It is what it is. But look, why has Katie Taylor gone for 10 rounds of two against Amanda Serrano when Serrano kind of said she wanted to have 3-minute rounds in future? Why has one given in, and why is Katie so adamant she wanted a 2 minutes?
I'd say power, possibly. She has the right to choose. Serrano is determined to fight 12 threes. She's called for it. And don't give your opponent what she wants, effectively. Serrano has experience fighting a 12 by 3 minute round in her last fight against Daniela Ramos in Orlando. She went the distance to 36 minutes. Taylor hasn't done it. Now, she did say after her last fight against Chantel Cameron that she was willing to do it. She said, I'd be happy to do it. I think the 12 threes would suit the boxer more than the fighter, so I'd be very, very happy to do the 12 threes. But when push came to shove, the ball was in her court. She's defending her world titles, not the other way around. And that's something she could dictate, and usually that's what the champion does.
Serrano's coming up to Katie's weight, though. You'd imagine if you were a bigger boxer, surely the longer you had someone standing in front of you. Or is it the other way around?
But it's hard to know, but possibly just control everything you can. She's already beaten Serrano once over 10 2-minute rounds, so she's got the opportunity. She knows what she needs to do to get the win again. So, yeah, I think it would be a different and an interesting spectacle if they did the 12 threes, but I think part of what makes women's boxing so interesting and successful at the minute is the pace at which the fights are boxed at. 10-2s has delivered, really. It's been a success.
What about crowds? So, obviously, there was a huge Irish crowd in New York, people that were there, and people travelled over, and it was an epic occasion, a great night, just a really good environment for everybody to be in. What do you think it's going to be like in Texas?
It's not Madison Square Garden, sure it's not. Marie, I think you were over there yourself, weren't you? And I know there was a report recently that Katie Taylor could fight at the Sphere in Las Vegas. I think she attended the U2 concert there, and there was a report that she could fight there as well. We've seen her sell out Dublin a couple of times, generate massive atmospheres in the UK as well, but I don't think this is going to be a massively pro Katie Taylor crowd. Will they sell it out? Possibly 80,000 at the AT&T Stadium, but it's not exactly going to be a partisan Katie Taylor crowd, no. And Texas hasn't been a happy hunting ground for Irish boxers either in the past. Andy Lee lost his first world title shot there against Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., who also ended John Duddy's career in Texas as well a couple of years before that. So Taylor has to overcome that one.
Is it anywhere close to Dallas? I know you can fly to Dallas from Dublin. Dallas is Texas.
I think Dallas would be the flight, so yeah.
Okay.
You heading over, Ruby?
I'm sure Maria's going. That's what I was kind of asking there.
The issue I have is that Clare are going to be in the All-Ireland Hurling Final on the Sunday, and that's on the Saturday, so I just need to check the flight times and when it'd be over, and if I'd make it back in time to get to Croke Park to see them lift the Liam McCarthy, but that's a problem for another day.
Yeah.
Just on the exhibition fight, I think we're probably calling it that at this stage. Like, what's it going to be? We know what shape Jake Paul is in, because, you know, we see him all the time. But what's Mike Tyson going to be able to do at that age?
Well, Mike Tyson hasn't had a proper fight since the year 2005 when Ireland's own Kevin McBride from Monaghan beat him, knocked him out, and, you know, effectively ended his career. Tyson had been kind of stuttering for a while. He lost to Britain's Danny Williams as well. So that was the end of him. He spent nearly 20 years as a retired boxer. Then he returned during kind of COVID, had a bit of an exhibition bout against Roy Jones Jr. Suddenly, Mike Tyson was the talk of boxing. His name was, when there was no competitive action taking place, he found himself thrust out as the biggest name in boxing. Jake Paul has obviously made his name, made his fame, and I don't really get the I don't really get what the attraction is of this fight, except just, you know, it's going to make a lot of money. I'd imagine that Jake Paul and Mike Tyson probably have effectively a gentlemanly agreement that both of them are going to make an awful lot of money from this fight. It's been rumoured in the past that some of Jake Paul's contests have almost like a no knockout clause and stuff like that, so will there be even proper scoring judges and things like that? It's unclear as of yet. I don't think it's a fight boxing fans are really energised about, though, that's for sure. However, so, I do think it'll draw more eyeballs probably than Tyson Fury against Alexander Usyk for all of the belts at heavyweight, which is taking place in Saudi Arabia later this year.
So it kind of sounds like you have one punch, I'll have a punch. That kind of a fight.
Yeah, and like, you know, it's even hard to call a winner because Jake Paul's a fit, active young man in his 20s.
Is it safe?
And he's fighting against an old man who's nearly 60 years old. It's not safe. It's certainly not safe for Mike Tyson to be boxing in the ring at his age. Nobody should be boxing at that age. And yes, he's going up against the former, you know, Iron Mike, baddest man on the planet. He doesn't have the qualifications to do so. Like prime Mike Tyson, you know what I mean? He knocks out Jake Paul on his way to the ring, just, you know, his wind. But it's different. It's different now. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see if people are inclined to tune in. But I'd imagine the boxing fans will be tuning in now because they have added a bit of a very credible fight, the most anticipated fight in women's boxing, this rematch between Katie Taylor and Amanda Serrano.
That's a good way of looking at it, all right, because it does give it credibility. Do you think it's the right move for Katie to go under this, to go on the same card as an exhibition fight of YouTuber? When
the exhibition factor or the circus factor, I wouldn't really have a qualm with it. Like, I mean, effectively, that fight shouldn't even be legal, really. Like, you know, Mike Tyson has no business having a license for this fight. But the fact that it's taking place, it's going to be on Netflix, it's generating so much money, and it could be an 80,000 sellout at the AT&T Stadium. All that makes sense as a card for Taylor to take part on. However, I guess Mike Tyson has a history, and Jake Paul has a history as well, accusations. And, you know, is that the sort of event Taylor wants to take part in? Well, clearly, you know, it's worth it. The paycheck is big enough. The paycheck is so big that Eddie Hearn, her promoter, and Matchroom Sports, who have been promoting her since the very start, her professional debut in 2016, they've no involvement with this card. They've just let Taylor go on this almost as a sole trader. The Zone, who've shown all her fights for the last couple of years since she moved over from Sky Sports, they have nothing to do with it either. It's just such a big offer. They made them an offer Taylor couldn't refuse. Sean McGoldrick from the Irish Independent has reported $6 million for Taylor tonight.
Right.
Which is a staggering amount of money. It's more than any Irishman's
made. I hope he's right.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, absolutely. And even from Amanda Serrano's point of view, like, find yourself someone who looks after your career the way Jake Paul has looked after Amanda Serrano. I think in their very first involvement, he got her she fought Katie Taylor in the most lucrative female fight of all time. After that, she fulfilled her dream, becoming an undisputed champion at featherweight. She's fought her 12 trees, and now she gets the Katie Taylor rematch. Since she's linked up with Jake Paul, it's been a brilliant working relationship for her as well. So I think both women are going to be, you know, massively well paid for this one. And, you know, you could say at least it's not in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. And I'm sure there's a Netflix documentary or some sort of a fly in the wall series been made as we speak. Just on then, post this fight, I know the Crow Park thing still looms large over Katie Taylor, and that Crow Park homecoming, she did obviously get to Dublin, but I don't think it was maybe at the level that she would have dreamed of. Do you think that's still something that's in her future, or are we getting to the stage, Kevin, where it's almost going to be, this could be it soon?
I would say probably not. Like, I mean, I was reasonably confident after Taylor beat Chantal Cameron in the rematch last November. That the talk was so strong. Taylor was so strong in almost demanding it of her promoter, Eddie Hearn, who, in fairness, has a good track record of delivering for his fighters what they want, what they demand. Taylor and Brian Peters, I thought, would be a very persuasive duo, and it would happen. And like, Matchroom Sports are a very profitable company, very rich company, and especially in recent years since they're dealing with the Saudis as well, like there's blank checks going all over the place here. So I thought it was this summer or bust, really. Like, and the fact that it hasn't taken place, and the fact that they haven't been able to secure the Aviva Stadium, I'm not really sure we'll ever see Taylor in a stadium fight back at home. So maybe a stadium fight in Texas for her is the next best thing.
Be very warm, so that's good for the fans who travel over.
35 degrees during the day in Texas in July.
Right.
But I think the AT&T has air conditioning. I think it's known as the biggest air conditioned room in the world. So it mightn't be too bad.
Okay, well, something to look forward to, put in the diary, and we'll see what plays out over the next few months. Kevin, thank you as always for all of that information. We're going to take a very quick break and we'll be back with Paul Townend.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Well, I'm delighted to say that we're going to be joined on the line now by Grand National winning jockey Paul Townend. Paul, how does that sound?
Sounds good, yeah. We tried enough times to get it, so as I say, if you fail once, keep trying again.
Exactly. But Paul, look, it was an incredible afternoon for you on Saturday. I am Maximus, a horse who won an Irish Grand National for you. Can't say I thought he was tailor-made for the place myself, but it went pretty well for you.
It did, to be honest. Look, it's a unique test, I suppose, around the entries in the unique race, and tragically took plans, so that was a surprise. But he actually took to it quite well. The fence was very well. Got a bit of a scare in the middle, but he got his confidence back pretty well.
You say you got a scare in the middle. When he did clatter the chair, that hundredth of a second, did you think, oh no, this is over?
I did. Finished there, but he's quite sure of his feet and things. He lands flat enough, so it was just hoping I was going to be on his left away from it, and we were fortunate.
You most certainly were. Obviously, a huge number of runners still were in contention as they sailed back over the Melling Road. Were you always confident, or did you think, oof, I'm going to need a bit of luck here?
I did need luck. So many in contention, and it bunched up there. Everyone was trying to hang on to a little bit. But when I gave him a squeeze in the gap across the Melling Road, he came alive. So I was following the two of them. Jack, and I was trying to keep my powder dry then for one round.
Paul, I tell you what, your line is falling and dropping. We might try and ring you back in a second, if that's all right, so we can get a bit of better connection so that people at home can actually hear you. Marie, is that a good call, or am I chancing my arm?
A good call. You can tell me now what you thought of the race then.
What I thought of the race, I thought it was a great race to watch. I thought, after all the drama of last year's Grand National, the 23 race, Marie, and things that went wrong, and I just thought it was a great result for the race to watch a race that you didn't know what was going to happen, what was going to win. I thought it was a brilliant race to watch. Not everybody agrees with me, but I thought it was a fantastic race to watch. And to be fair with you, when you watch back replays, and I was lucky enough to do that for ITV, like, he gave Aya Maximus a cracking right down the inside, always in the right place on him, but he's kind of been doing that all year, and he's back now. She heard me saying that, but anyway.
He's back now. Classic Paul, doing all the right things at the right time. How are you, Paul?
I'm glad it's unlike him to be that confident.
is he that nice to your face now when you're going around the yard at Willie's? Is he nice to be around? Because we could spend maybe the next like 5 or 6 minutes just talking about what it's like to work at Ruby every day.
No, he's, to be fair to him, he always has, and very good to me. And look, it's a nice position to be in, to be able to pick up the phone if you have a question about something and ring someone with the experience he has. So we can't give out about him too much.
But winning a Grand National, Paul, it is different. I know you've had huge success at Cheltenham and an incredible year this year, a 4-goal cup, but those last 50 yards in a Grand National when you're going to win, there's something really different about it.
There's There is actually, to be fair. Like, I thought you couldn't top or get close to winning the Gold Cup. You know, that kind of release of excitement and everything, but it definitely leveled it. You need so much luck going out in a big handicap like that to ones, you know, yourself. They're so tactical, and you know, if you get things right and you don't have bad luck, you know, you have a fair chance of winning the great ones. But you need a lot of things to go right, and you need a lot of people to fall your way in a big handicap like that.
Things have been going your way all season, and entry was another massive step and stone on it, but you are in a fair tussle to regain your jockey championship. Yourself and Jack Kennedy were both in ace today, a winner apiece. There's still four between you, and this is getting exciting for a jockey championship. Probably not for you.
Yeah, not for me. For everyone else, maybe. Yeah. No, it'll be tough going. It'll be tough pegging back. He's had a brilliant season. So have I. What'll be? You need luck for the whole season for a championship. So obviously we have a look at it, but we're still in there with a fight dance and come. We'll still be there the last day of punches down, and what will be.
Paul, where does the consistency come from? Because we talk about it all the time on this programme, that athletes in all different sports, they struggle to perform consistently game after game, week after week, but you seem to be able to do it.
Probably riding for William Mullins is a huge help. And what else comes with that then? The ball bouncing for me, and when you're in winners and good horses, you can afford to take it and hopefully, you know, seem to happen when you're across.
I think we've lost Paul. I mentioned the word consistency and his line went.
But that is it. And what himself and Jack Kennedy doing. And it's great to see Jack Kennedy doing it, Marie, because he's had such a torrid time for so many years with injury. I'd say, like, Jack Kennedy can't believe that he has ridden from early last July and is still in the one piece riding. I couldn't tell you the last time he had a full season. So, and you even look at, like, Paul Roddy's 113th winner today. That's more than he has ever ridden in a season, and he's still four behind Jack. So, like, they are driving each other, and it's going to get interesting, because obviously William Mullins is now winning the Trainers' Championship in the UK. Paul has allowed Danny to go to Cheltenham tomorrow, and Paul is going to Clonmel. But when you look at the schedule that these lads are going to put in for the next fortnight, it's incredible.
Okay, well, look forward to see how that one plays out as well. We're going to turn our attention to rugby now, and Ireland head coach Scott Beamond looks set to have a full squad to choose from for Saturday's Women's Guinness Six Nations meeting with England at Twickenham. And a little bit earlier, he spoke to Michael Corcoran.
I had quite an accurate reflection of the game straight after, whereby, you know, where we did well, where we had good disciplined approach to game plan and putting the Welsh under pressure. And then we've sort of reviewed and reflected, and we left a few points out there. So, look, there's the game of rugby, there's always going to be plenty that you can keep going after. Always different areas of the game. The game gives you a bunch of stuff as well that is slightly unusual. So the scenario finishing at the end with 14... You know, we were in an advantageous position where we didn't have to necessarily worry as much about the scoreboard in terms of the pressure and the points up that we had for that. You know, we could take Aoife Wafer off early. And then the adaptability of the players, you know, we put a centre at flanker, and, you know, that'll build layers of experience for the girls. So there's plenty that we've learnt from it. Plenty of things to go after where we can put more of our game out there and get more points. But really happy that the girls have also been able to see the positives as well, and hopefully that continues to build confidence.
How do you approach selection this week, given the fact that, you know, unlike the start of the competition where you had a game and then a break, you're now at a scenario where there's a game last week, a game this week, and a game the following week. You've three massive matches, to be fair about it, in the context of where you want to finish in the pool.
So we've got a pretty normal week. And how we prepare and the game and what have you. So we're avoiding spikes. You know, the game gives you what it gives you, but our training performance is hopefully building layers of resilience within the players that the game shouldn't be too hard or too easy or whatever. So we train pretty hard, which kind of allows us to go these runs of games and hopefully, like, we're in pretty good fettle at the minute.
So it's against a team that you're obviously very familiar with, the vast majority of them. When you turn the page on Sunday and you saw England written at the top and you thought, wow, sorry, I normally look and see the other side of it, if you understand what I mean. So it'll be a kind of slightly strange experience for you this week.
Oh, it's part of the modern game, isn't it? As players, we sometimes move clubs. As coaches, you coach different environments. Look, it's fantastic to see them going well. It's fantastic to be able to go to Twickenham in something I know that they do very well and put a show on there. I was there last year for that last game against France, and there's 59,000 people. So we know there'll be an atmosphere, we know there'll be an occasion, and I think it's an unbelievable opportunity for our players to see that. You know, it's in the not too distant future, we want to be doing something similar at the Aviva. We know where we come from, we know where we're heading towards, and actually we're making some pretty good steps, some pretty quick steps towards that. So look, the next part of it is closing the gap on these World Cup contenders. We go there with a little bit of confidence. We will be after our game. We know some bits of our game that hopefully can cause some problems. I'm just really excited to see how the girls handle it.
And how important is it that the girls play the game, not the occasion, if you understand, given the fact I think there's nearly 45,000-46,000 tickets sold as we sit here today? I mean, it's massive. Most of them will never have even been in front of a crowd like that before.
No, these are the days that you play rugby for. You know, when you finish playing rugby, you look back on it and you kind of think it was a blink of an eye. So the girls have got this opportunity really to put their best out there in a grand occasion. So there's certainly no fear of the arena, of the noise, or anything like that. It'll just excite our players. Some of them have been there, some of them haven't. But with that comes the opportunity of, they don't come with sort of pre-thought about what it may or may not be. They'll just play the game. So really excited to see how they go.
Well, that is all we have time for this evening. Shane is in tomorrow. Betty De Silva is up next. RTE 2FM.